He strode to the recliner opposite from the couch I was sitting on and took a seat. By the open Doritos bag and cracked soda cans littering the coffee table, I gathered he'd made himself at home before my arrival. If nothing else, at least now I knew who was responsible for making my life a living hell the past few months. I was waiting for Jesus to come to me and tell me, "Now's not your time, child," because all other indicators pretty much pointed to my early and tragic demise. Ugh. Getting offed by a disgruntled ex-employee was such an embarrassing way to die. "How can I help you, Frank?" I asked, businesslike, which was hard considering the circumstances. Baby Whitehall fluttered like crazy in my stomach, and I thought, with a mixture of devastation and exhilaration, how much I wanted this to continue. The flutter, the kicks, and what came after. For the first time in my life, I had something to fight for. Two, some things. There was Devin, too, and as much as it frightened me to admit to myself, he wasn't like the men who'd let me down. I traded my soul to the devil the day I had taken revenge on Coach. I'd paid for the pleasure of taking a life with my youth, with my joy, with my innocence. Lacking all three made it impossible for me to get attached to a man. But Devin Whitehall wasn't just a man. He was much more.
"You can start by telling me what the fuck I ever did to you."
Frank grabbed the knife he'd threatened me with and pointed at me from across the living room, spitting each word out.
"Why'd you fire me when I had a pregnant girlfriend at home? My mom's medical bills. You know, she passed away 2 weeks before you fired me. I took a week off. You didn't even send me a sympathy card. Nothing."
Pursing my lips, I closed my eyes and thought back to that period of time. When I wasn't working, I was partying. Hard. There were a string of house parties, then charity events, then a girl's baby moon weekend in Cabo for Percy and Ashling. I'd relied on Ross to play mommy and daddy at Madame Mayhem and didn't much care about what was going on in other people's lives. I was busy keeping myself distracted, because that was how I coped whenever memories of Mr. Locken and what I'd done to him resurfaced. I didn't care about anything or anyone other than myself. Worst of all, I didn't remember ever hearing that Frank's mom had passed away. "I'm sorry for your loss," I tried to sound calm, but my words stumbled over one another. "I really am. But Frank, I didn't know about your mother or your girlfriend. Certainly not about your debt. I have a minimum of 30 employees on my payroll at any given time. All I knew was that you copped a feel and harassed one of the burlesque girls."
"That's what she said."
He sent his knife crashing against the coffee table between us. The blade kissed the glass and the thing shattered inward noisily.
"You went and told every local reporter I tried to rape her. I couldn't get a job, not even a temp one, not even washing the dishes. You humiliated me."
I swallowed down a yelp. Baby Whitehall felt like fingers strumming piano keys, running from left to right, then left again. "Frank, I saw you," I insisted, exasperated. "Your hand was on the curve of her ass. Your other hand was shoved between her legs." I remembered how they both reacted when I walked in on the scene, how she was in tears, how he was in shock.
"I wasn't harassing her."
Frank darted up from the beige chaise, grabbing a soda can and smashing it against the wall. Orange liquid splashed across it like an abstract painting, dripping onto the floor. I wanted to believe one of the neighbors might hear the commotion and call for help, but knew that the houses were far too apart for that to happen. Damn middle-class suburbia.
"We were having an affair. Christine and I were having an affair. I was fingering her when you walked in on us, and she got scared because she knew you were a no-bullshit kind of boss, and also because it was known around the club that my girlfriend was pregnant. She didn't want to look like a homewrecker or a slut, even though, for the record, she was both. So she made up that story that I harassed her."
I deeply resented his characterization of Christine, even though I didn't agree with her behavior. It took two to tango, and no one forced this asshole to have an affair with her. Of course, this was hardly the time to retaliate by sending truth bombs his way. I didn't know all that. I hated how small my voice was.
Yeah, well, that's because you never bothered giving half a shit about anything that wasn't your club, your parties, your clothes, and your one-night stands. Christine went after me. She knew I had access to Ross's calendar and schedule. I messed with it, giving her better hours and shifts when he wasn't looking.
He picked up his knife from the ocean of broken glass in the middle of the living room, wiping it on the side of his jeans. I moved uncomfortably on the couch. The duct tape was digging into my wrists, and I wanted to stretch my legs. Look, Frank, I'm sorry if—
I'm not done,
he roared, getting in my face. His cheeks were flushed, his eyes dancing with madness.
I lost everything. My girlfriend found out. Of course she did. I got fired publicly, after all, and no one would hire me. Every time we left the house, a reporter or a photographer loitered nearby because everyone likes a train wreck story of a guy with a pregnant teenage girlfriend who harassed a burlesque girl and got his ass kicked by the manager of a club for it. My girlfriend didn't leave, but she wouldn't fucking let that shit go. Christine, the bitch, left the burlesque show and moved back to Cincinnati to marry some old fuck. He's about to be in for a surprise when he realizes the baby she's cooking for him belongs to me. And me? I got hooked on fentanyl. Because, you know, why the hell not?
He cackled tonelessly. Oh boy. If you'd have told me—
You'd have done nothing,
he barked. And I knew it was the truth.
You hate men. Everyone knows that. Everyone.
I wanted to throw up. All this time, I was partly responsible for his girlfriend's condition. I remembered seeing her at Bye Bye Baby. How distressed she looked. He began kicking things around as he spoke, determined to inflict as much destruction on me and mine.
Things got really bad at home. After a while, I just up and left, like my daddy did before I was born. I couldn't deal with it, and now there's this cycle, you see, that you created. My son is going to come into this world with nothing while your kid is going to come into this world with everything. And why? Because you have a pretty face? A tight ass? Because your sister married some rich guy and now you two are prancing around like millionaires all day?
I knew where this was going, and I didn't like it. Not one bit. You were the one who went after me. But who was that man who came to Madame Mayhem to threaten me?
My stepdad.
Frank shrugged.
Did me a solid. Good guy, huh?
And the man at Boston Common?
Boston Common? He frowned. Ain't nobody went for you there.
My head was spinning. There were a few people after me. Frank was on a roll, though, and wasn't exactly in the mood to answer any more of my questions.
Well, I'm here to tell you, if my baby is not going to have a future, and I certainly can't give him a future.
His blade found my heart, moving down my skin toward my belly as he crouched down before me.
Then yours is not going to have one either.
Frank, please. The knife halted on my belly. He smiled as he poked the blade into it, breaking the skin. And that was when one of the living room walls came crashing down.
Devon. I arrived at the Penrose parents' suburban house to find Belle's father's truck parked out front. Though it wasn't necessarily in my plans to try and win Mr. Penrose over by explaining that my mother had sent people to threaten his daughter, and that I may or may not have planned to marry someone else at one point, I was going to have to deal with him. After I informed Belle we were getting married this week and stopping this nonsense, of course. I walked over to the door, determined, and raised my knuckles to rap the door. Just then, a crash sounded from the inside. It sounded like glass shattering. I moved toward one of the windows, peeking inside. Belle was sitting on the couch, mostly naked and duct-taped, while a frank-looking guy, I'd never seen the man, but again, deductive reasoning, stood above a pile of glass, a knife at his feet. I pressed my hands to the glass and roared, but they couldn't hear me. I could tell by the thickness of the glass and by the blurry way I saw them that it was too thick. I rushed over to the door and tried to pick the lock, but fuck, it wouldn't budge. It wasn't a flimsy door either, It was one of those steel security doors Killian had installed in his mansion the day Asta was born. I couldn't kick that shit down if I had the rocks quads. Frantically, I rounded the house, trying to find a way to break in. I tilted my head and looked up to see if the windows on the second floor were open or maybe not triple glazed. No such luck. After a quick inspection, I realized the only way in was through the ventilation. There was only one problem. Confined places and I weren't exactly good friends. Staring at the exhaust hole on the side of the house, I reminded myself that I didn't have a choice. That it was either me dying in a space smaller than the dumbwaiter or Belle. Fuck, I couldn't even begin to think about what could happen to her. Pulling my phone out of my pocket, I called 911 and explained the situation, giving them the address, then crouched into the hole and crawled right in. It wasn't the type of air duct you saw in the movies. The square, never-ending metal labyrinth you could crawl comfortably in. It was a round, flimsy one that could only carry my weight because it was bellied between bricks, the surface uneven from every direction. It felt like skulking into someone's arsehole. I had to army crawl on my elbows and knees, collecting dust, mold, dirt, and mites on my Cuccinelli suit, which turned from navy blue to gray. My throat was thick with dirt, and every one of my muscles felt strained and shaky. Putting myself in this position was something I never thought I'd do, but I had to. I had to save her. To help ease the pain, I squeezed my eyes shut and kept pushing. I sometimes knocked into a dead end and maneuvered myself left, right, up, and down until I found the next curve to take what would lead me to the other side. You're not going to die. You're not going to die. You're not going to die. I pushed harder, faster, my legs cramping and my biceps hurting. After a few feet, I heard voices again. It was only then that I dared open my eyes. They stung with sweat and dust. The aircon fan looked back at me. I was only a few feet away. The voice rose from underneath it. If you'd have told me, Emmabelle tried, her voice brave and strong and everything she was that I loved so much. You'd have done nothing, he roared. I pushed myself farther, wriggling like a worm toward the opening of the air duct. Well, I'm here to tell you, if my baby is not going to have a future, and I certainly can't give him a future, then yours is not going to have one either. Just as he said it, I punched the air duct open and fell right through it, bringing half the wall down with me. I lifted myself up, even though a sharp, tear-jerking pain in my left leg told me I'd almost certainly broke it. Frank turned around, and I used the element of surprise to pounce on him, throwing all my weight against him and reaching for his knife. Unfortunately, he had the upper hand of not needing to crawl his way into this place seconds ago. He stuck the knife in my shoulder, twisting it about. I let out a growl, pushing my fingers into his eye sockets. I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew I wasn't going to die before knowing Emmabelle was safe. From my periphery, I could see Belle hopping her way from the couch to the kitchen awkwardly, still bound at the ankles and wrists. A line of blood ran down from under her belly button, disappearing into her panties. My mind kicked into overdrive. If something happened to that baby, my baby. Ah! Frank was screaming, letting go of the knife, which was still, by the fucking way, in my shoulder, waving his arms in the air helplessly. My eyes! My eyes! There was a warm pool of blood underneath us, and I knew it belonged to me. I couldn't keep it up any longer. Concentrating, I tried to scoop out one of his eyeballs, which wasn't as easy as he made it sound, since his eye sockets were pure, dense bone, and I had to crack through them. Stop! Frank roared. Stop! But then he was the one who stopped. In fact, he fell right on top of me, driving the knife even deeper into my shoulder as he collapsed. There was a steak knife stuck in his back, and above him stood Emmabelle, breathing hard. Now, I decided, was a perfect time to succumb to unconsciousness. So that was what I did. Chapter 38. Devon. I woke up in a hospital bed. Everything hurt. Everything other than my shoulder, which I couldn't feel at all. I snuck a peek down at it, frowning, and saw that it was bandaged and in a sling. My eyes wandered around the room, which seemed to be never-ending wall-to-wall light oak cabinets and medical equipment. Killian stood in front of a window overlooking the parking lot, talking quietly on the phone. Hunter sat on a recliner beside him, typing on his laptop, and I could hear Sam's voice carrying in from the hallway. My mates were here. My family, naturally, was not. But what really worried me was Swevin.
Amabel.
That was the first word that left my mouth. Killian swiveled, his signature cold gaze rolling over me like an icicle. She's fine, he assured me. Persephone finally managed to pry her away from your side to get some checkups done. The doctors are keeping her for observation.
I need to see her.
She's three rooms down. Hunter looked up from his laptop, closing it. I stared at him point blank and said again, I need to see her.
Okay, okay. A crazy bitch with some unsolved daddy issues coming right up.
Hunter murmured, placing his laptop on the light oak wooden table and scurrying out of the room. I closed my eyes, dropping my head back to the pillow.
Is this all my bloody American health insurance bought me? This place is one fruit bowl away from being someone's 90s-style kitchen.
Be thankful the wood you're surrounded by isn't a coffin, Killian clipped. The door opened and Sam walked in. I'd never been overtly happy to see the guy. But now I was downright disappointed. I was expecting Bell. He closed the door after him, holding his phone.
I'm sure you'd like to know my service is no longer needed. Simon's out too. Frank's dead, thanks to the deranged woman you're in love with. And the man your mother hired, Rick Lawhan, is taken care of. I knew taken care of was code for pining for the fjords. Brennan was an extremely prolific killer. If we ever hit an overpopulation issue in the States, I had no doubt he'd be the bloke to fix it. I need to see her. I decided to simply parrot myself until Belle was put in front of me, alive, well, and happily pregnant. Still, I couldn't ask either of them if the baby was okay. The question seemed too intimate, and I didn't trust myself not to bawl, no matter the answer.
Persephone is pushing her wheelchair down the hallway now, Sam said.
Wheelchair.
Coming through, please make room, Percy chirped just then.
Killian hurried to open the door for her and she walked in, pushing Swevin inside. Amabel looked tired in a pale blue hospital gown. Her hands were folded in front of her. I couldn't see her stomach from that angle. Persephone parked her at the edge of my hospital bed. I swallowed hard, everything inside me burning. Everybody get out. I need to speak to Belle. They all did. Belle stared at me for a moment, blinking slowly, as if I was a complete stranger. Bloody hell, I hoped she hadn't lost her memory. I had just committed a heroic act, possibly the only heroic act I'd ever committed, past, present, and future, and I needed her to know about it so we could stop fucking around. The baby. I started, then stopped. A part of me was frightened to know. I did see blood before I passed out at her parents. She leaned forward, resting her cold, clammy hand against my warm one on the bed.
She's fine.
I nodded gravely, my jaw tense so I wouldn't weep in relief like a little girl. Good. And you? How are you feeling? I asked.
I'm also fine.
Lovely. Silence. I tried to twitch my fingers to put my hand on top of hers, but my entire arm and shoulder felt immobile. Am I paralyzed? I asked conversationally.
No, she smiled, her eyes shining. But you're under the influence of painkillers, dude.
Marvelous, I smiled tiredly.
We both laughed.
You got into an air duct for me, Belle choked on the words. And you're claustrophobic.
Finally, I was recognized for my greatness. You were in danger. I half shrugged with my healthy shoulder. It was a no-brainer. This made her break down in tears. She buried her head in the linen next to my legs, her whole body quivering with sobs.
I'm so sorry, Devon. I screwed everything up, didn't I?
Oh, shush, darling, of course not. I made an effort to move my hand and this time succeeded, stroking her hair. For the record, she absolutely did cock up, but I was being a gentleman about it. Also, what are you referring to exactly when you say you screwed everything up? I cleared my throat. She looked up, wiping her tears with the back of her sleeve, sniffling.
I took a check from Louisa,
she hiccuped. I know, I continued to stroke her cheek. She told me.
And then I left you without even explaining myself.
Yes, yes, I was there for the entire show, remember? I grinned. She stopped, tilted her head, frowned.
Devon, why aren't you mad at me? She demanded. It is not okay for you to accept this kind of behavior. What are you, a doormat?
A doormat? No, I said, amused. But I am in love with a woman who suffered severe trauma when she was a wee girl. Love has failed you many times. You were never shy about it. I was the one who pushed you out of your comfort zone.
My comfort zone sucked.
She elevated an eyebrow, looking more and more like herself. I tried hard not to laugh, tilting my head against the pillow as I studied her. I know, Swevin.
I thought you'd never call me that anymore.
Her eyes filled with fresh tears.
Why?
Now I did laugh.
Because I told you to marry someone else.
I don't know how to break this to you. I laced my fingers in hers. But not every single thing you are going to tell me to do will be followed through dutifully. There was contemplative silence in which both of us realized we were lucky to be here, in this room, alive.
I burned the check,
she sniffed, finally. I know. I had no doubt in my mind she'd spurn taking money from Louisa, even if she had been tempted for a moment or two. Which was why I kept fighting for her, even when things were looking dreadful. Why are you in a wheelchair?
Hospital policy.
Why didn't you use the gun? I asked out of nowhere. She flinched. It took us both back to that scene when Frank attacked her.
I was too afraid I'd accidentally kill you. I didn't want to take any chances.
That is the most romantic thing you've ever said to me.
And also,
she drew a breath, closing her eyes.
My hands are far from clean in this department.
She opened her eyes again, and she looked different this time. Complex, powerful, dangerous. A Valkyrie. I swore she stood 6 inches taller than me in that moment.
I know the consequences and complexities of taking a life. I didn't want to do it unless I absolutely had to.
She hoisted herself up on the bed, nestling next to me, her hard, round stomach pressed against my side. My cock immediately stood up in appreciation. She laced her arms over me, careful not to touch my shoulder, and pressed her mouth to my ear.
Devon Whitehall, you're the most gorgeous, funny, smart, witty, bougie man on planet Earth. And I'm madly in love with you. Have been from the moment our paths crossed, and it pains me to say that I don't think any man could ever measure up to you, which is why I might as well stop fighting this.
Bloody right. I turned to kiss her lips softly. Swevin?
No,
she said. I pulled away from her, frowning. You don't know what I was about to ask.
Yes, I do, and the answer is no. I want to ask you that, but I want to do it properly. On one knee.
Belle pursed her lips.
There are far more interesting things you can do on your knees for me, sweetheart. Permit me this indulgence.
No can do, Hardy.
She leaned in to kiss my nose, then gave it a mocking bite.
I love you, though.
Love you, too.
Devin?
She hesitated. Oh, no, I thought. I couldn't take more. Yes, my love?
Can I tell you something?
Of course.
Frank is not the only person I've killed in my life. I just want to come clean before we take the next step.
Shite. Well, if there was a body we needed to get rid of, I suppose that was just the way it was going to be. Personally, I wasn't a fan of people being killed for any reason, but for Belle, well, I mean, what could a man do? I'll take care of it, I clipped. She looked at me funnily, then began to laugh. What was so funny? But then she said,
No, no, it's not recent. It happened a long time ago. It was the person who abused me.
Your dad? I asked, confused. Now she looked disordered.
My dad? He didn't abuse me.
I thought you two had a weird relationship.
Yeah, I held a grudge because he cheated on my mom.
Oh, I said, for lack of a better answer. So tell me about the other person. And she did. She told me about Mr. Locken, about her youth, about the attack, about the miscarriage, and about her revenge. At the end of it all, I gathered her into my arms and kissed her with such ferocity I thought we would both burn alive.
Do you still love me, then?
She asked uncertainly. Love is a very weak word for what I feel for you, Swevin.
Thanks for making me lose my appetite. You should start your own diet method.
Sailor strode into the room, followed by Persephone and Ashling, their husbands not too far behind. Suddenly, the room was full of people who'd been there for me, and just then I realized that I did have a family. We just weren't blood related.
You two getting married?
Sam leaned against the foot of the bed, draping an arm over Ashling's shoulder.
Not yet. I need to propose to him first.
Belle propped her head against my shoulder, and it hurt like all the bitches on planet Earth, but obviously I did not say a thing.
Would you look at that? Not even married, and she already wears the pants in this relationship.
Hunter jerked a thumb in her direction, laughing.
Knowing Devin, he'll find a way to get her out of them.
Killian smiled, and for a second there looked almost human. Everybody laughed. This was the essence of family. 2 weeks later, I landed in England. This time with Belle. She was in her second trimester, the perfect time for travel, according to Dr. Bjorn, anyway.
I don't know what's worse, my constipation or my heartburn.
The love of my life waxed poetic as she slid into the Range Rover waiting for us at Heathrow. This time, I opted to drive myself around London. I preferred conducting my business without running the risk of being spotted by the tabloids.
I'll have Joanne book an appointment with Dr. Bjorn as soon as we get back home.
I kissed the side of her head, starting the car.
Thanks.
Are you experiencing any cravings yet? Anything you'd like?
I swerved the Range Rover into a mile-long queue to get out of the airport limits.
Do true crime podcasts and coal count as cravings?
Swevin?
Chillax,
she yawned, gathering her ice-blonde locks into a high bun.
No weird cravings, other than sex.
I was delighted to oblige in that department. Belle had moved back to my flat as soon as we got discharged from the hospital, and this time there were no games between us. No crazy stalkers either, a lovely development. Unfortunately, the woman still didn't make things easy for me. 2 weeks had passed since I'd almost proposed to her at the hospital, and she still hadn't popped the question. I was trying to respect her feminist values, and was also perhaps a tad nervous she'd rip my bollocks off if I asked again.
Oh, could you please ask Joanne to ask Dr. Bjorn if it's normal for me to have ankles the size of water bottles?
I could tell Belle was in the mood to list all the ways baby Whitehall had turned her body into her own Motel 6 when London caught her eye. She sucked in a breath, her pupils dilating,
swallowing those azure irises. Holy shit, Dev. This place looks like a Harry Potter set.
I looked around to see piles upon piles of stingy, never-ending council flats. I'll ask Joanne to book you an appointment with the optometrist while she's at it.
Shut up, it's Purdy.
I'll show you Purdy once we leave my solicitor's office in Knightsbridge.
Actually,
she turned to look at me, grinning. I'm going solo for a shopping spree. Gotta hit them stores fast and hard to get all my shopping done.
I'll only take a couple hours, I frowned. Though Frank and Rick were out of the picture, I was still worried Emmabelle was targeted. Louisa was somewhere out there in the wild, bitter about her unaccomplished mission. As much as I'd love to listen to two old farts dividing millions of pounds between charities, she batted her lashes theatrically as if this was a dream come true. I think I'm good. I was going to meet Harry Tyndall to sign over my inheritance to the charities of my choice. If the Whitehall wealth was going down the drain, I wanted to flush it to organizations that mattered to me. There's no one to watch over you, I argued. She cocked an eyebrow.
Hi, nice to meet you, Belle. Been living with myself for 30 years, still alive.
Just barely, I scoffed.
I'm going shopping, she cemented. I'm not going to crawl into any more air ducts for you, I warned, but knew I was about to concede.
What? Not even dumbwaiters?
Then, before I could answer, she patted her belly.
Don't worry, baby Whitehall. Once this old man is out of our way, we'll be binging on fossil fuel and murder mysteries.
I let her go. This time knowing she was going to come back. The meeting with Harry Tyndall stretched over 3.5 hours. I periodically checked my phone to ensure Belle was fine, and by periodically, I mean, of course, every 15 seconds. It was mostly productive in a sense that I ensured the Whitehall wealth had been donated to the British Red Cross, BHF, and Macmillan Cancer Support. Were it up to Edwin Whitehall, the money would have gone straight to hunting organizations, animal testing labs, and various terror groups. The man had had less of a heart than a jellyfish, and I had no doubt of his ability to worsen the human condition, even from beyond the grave.
This has tax relief written all over it, Tyndall purred, balancing the 3-ton stack of documents on his desk into one neat pile. I hope your CPA in the States knows how to make the most out of it.
I stood up. I'm not doing this for the money.
I know, he said apologetically, which is refreshing.
I headed for the door, eager to return to Emmabelle.
Devon, wait.
Tyndall stood up and wobbled to the door, grimacing like he was about to say something he shouldn't. I stopped at the threshold, throwing him a look. I knew he was probably less than impressed with how I chose to handle the will, and frankly, I could not give a quarter of a shite regarding the matter. He twisted his handlebar mustache between his fingers, a villainous gesture that made me stifle a laugh.
I just wanted you to know that, all in all, you turned out fantastically well, considering your upbringing, or lack of, really. Edwin was a dear friend, but he was also a difficult man.
Understatement of the millennium, I patted his shoulder. Nonetheless, I appreciate it.
No, really,
he gripped the door, stepping in front of me, blocking my way out.
For what it's worth, I'm pleased you didn't succumb to pressure. The Bouchards are an eccentric bunch. I wouldn't tie my fate in theirs.
One would think you'd have wanted Louisa and me to have the wedding of a decade. As a friend of my late father, I meant.
One would be wrong, Tyndall said, bowing his head modestly. You're a marquis now, Devin. You don't need anyone to assert your title.
Actually, I said, I don't need the title either. I smiled, taking one step out his door, already feeling my lungs expanding with fresh air and something else. Something I'd never felt before. Freedom. though I lamented that I would rather conduct a lengthy and passionate affair with a food processor, Emmabel insisted we go visit my mother at Whitehall Court Castle before we left the United Kingdom. The last person she wants to see is me, I groaned as I drove to Kent on autopilot. I threw her a look. She was buried in green and gold Harrods shopping bags. Actually, the last person she wants to see is you, I let out a chuckle. You're a reminder of all the things that went wrong with her plan. If you expect a hug in a spontaneous baby shower, you're in for disappointment. Your mom can shove it. Swevin rolled her eyes, checking her scarlet lipstick in the passenger mirror. I want to see where you grew up, even if I hate the place. Especially because you do. We arrived just before darkness creeped in. The green rolling hills of Kent came into view. I spotted the castle from a distance. It looked darker than I remembered, folding into itself like a shrinking violet. Like I knew how I'd turned my back on the Whitehall name, and it was not going to forgive me. Damn, bro. You make the Fitzpatricks look like the assholes down the street who could afford non-domestic vacations and an in-ground pool, Belle laughed. This is rich, rich. Like, mommy, can I have a diamond tiara for breakfast, rich? Should I have flaunted my wealth? I side-eyed her, cocking an eyebrow. Are you kidding me? She threw her arms over my neck, kissing my cheek. Harrod's bags collapsed between us, the symbol of love. I was scared shitless of average rich, Devon. You know how intimidated I'd have been if I knew you were employing asswipers and people whose entire job is to blow cold air on your tea? At this point, I lost the thread of the conversation. What was she on about? I pulled the Range Rover by the front gate, killed the engine, and got out. Swevin rounded the front of the car and joined me. It was still technically my estate. A few weeks ago, I'd planned to sign it over to my mother. Now, she'd lost that privilege too. Call me petty, but I did not appreciate how she'd sent someone to chase my girlfriend away. So, the current deal was that Mum, Cecilia, and Drew were to get the fuck out of there by the end of the month. Where to? I had no idea nor desire to know. I reached for Belle's hand when I noticed the trucks. There were three of them parked in a neat row in front of the entrance, trunks open. Young blokes in coveralls yelled at each other in Polish as they flung furniture into them. Devin? My sister's voice rang from the woods. I turned to see her making her way from the thick curtain of trees, lifting her skirts in one hand. Is that really you? She hurried toward me. My heart caught in my throat. Just for a second, she looked like the Cece I'd grown up with, the one I held by the legs and pretended her mass of blonde curls was a broomstick, sweeping the floor with them while she giggled. I blew raspberries on her bare stomach and told her to stop farting, taught her how to snap her fingers and whistle Patience by Guns N' Roses, and not just the chorus. Cecilia, this is my partner, Emmabel. Cecilia stopped dead in her tracks, measuring Belle head to toe. I saw Swevin through her eyes, a stunning self-made woman dressed like she was ready for her Vogue cover shoot. Hi, Cece smiled, offering Belle her hand, tentatively. Belle used it to jerk Cecilia into an embrace, hugging her tightly. You're beautiful, Cecilia blurted after managing to weasel her way out of Belle's hug. Thanks, and you're... holding a pogo stick? Belle poked her lower lip out, her eyes widening a little. Cecilia laughed, and I realized that she was holding a pogo stick. I lit up instantly. We used to race in the woods with pogo sticks to make it more difficult, I explained. I won every time. Every single time? Cecilia groaned, mock punching my arm. Even after he went to boarding school and I practiced daily, the minute he'd come back, he would leave me to eat dust. I wanted to do it one last time before... Well, Cecilia turned to smile at me. There was sadness there, yes, but no anger or malice. Already moving? I asked. She nodded. Mum can't afford to stay here. The bills are just too much.
There's no reason to postpone the inevitable. She is going off to London to stay with a friend.
What about you and Drew?
Cece wiped sweaty locks of gold from her forehead.
Drew found a job. Could you believe it?
No, I said flatly.
Cece laughed. Yes, he is starting from the ground up. An admin assistant for a private bank in Canary Wharf. Can you imagine him fetching coffee and getting people's dry cleaning?
I couldn't, in fact, but I was glad he managed to make use of himself nonetheless.
I signed up for uni. I think I'm going to become a vet.
She smiled sheepishly. I'll pay, I offered. After all, Cece was not a part of Mom and Louise's plans for Belle.
Cheers.
She reached to squeeze my arm.
But a bit of student debt didn't kill anyone last I checked, and it's time I do something on my own, don't you reckon?
Mom decided to make her grand entrance to this odd scene just then, walking out carrying a box full of knick-knacks.
Cecilia, what on earth is all this commotion, I?
Belle turned to look at her. The minute their eyes met, two things were clear to me. One, they both knew who the other one was. Two, if anyone was going to kill anyone, I'd put my money on Swevin and wouldn't even consider it a high-risk investment.
Oh,
Mother put the box down and pressed her fingers on her mouth like we were both naked standing there in her driveway. My mother couldn't stop staring at Emmabelle's stomach. The latter, in return, rubbed it protectively, like the woman in front of her was going to try and snatch the baby away if she wasn't careful. Her belly still had a shallow, faint scar from the whole ordeal with Frank, but Belle told me she loved it even more now. The story behind her pregnancy. How precious and rare our child was. Belle wanted to see where I grew up before we left. I took care of the will today. Everything's done. I draped an arm over my girlfriend's shoulder. My mother was still looking at Belle's belly with violent, hungry longing.
I hope it's to your liking.
She took a step toward the belly, and the woman it was attached to, acknowledging her for the very first time.
It's free for you to use. We're moving away. You caught us at a bit of an inconvenient time. Sorry, I cannot offer you any refreshments. My kitchens are all packed.
It's always a dud when all the kitchens are packed. I always leave, like, 3 fully stocked, just in case. Emmabelle offered her a feline smile, producing a lollipop from behind her ear, like a cigarette, unwrapping it and shoving it into the side of her mouth. She was a trickster. An unexpected rainbow in a bleak gray painting. A woman of many faces, many shapes, and many hats. Mother swallowed her with her eyes, fascinated.
Are all American women sarcastic?
No, ma'am. Only the good ones.
Your accent is so lazy.
You should see my workout routine.
Belle sucked hard on the lollipop, looking around her, like she was figuring out what she wanted to do with the place.
Oh, and yours sounds like you were born to chide small children for asking for a second helping of porridge.
That earned a snicker out of me.
I hear you're a stripper.
Mother tilted her chin up, but there was no defiance in her, only fascination. I took a step forward, ready to give her a verbal spanking. Belle put her hand on mine.
I'm not a stripper, but as someone who knows a few, I can tell you no stripper I've ever met fell behind on her bills. They usually do it to pay their way through college or to just make a quick buck. Lots of tips. Don't slam it before you try it.
My mother nodded. She was impressed, despite her best efforts.
You're different from what I imagined.
You should have never doubted it. Your son has great taste.
Mum turned to look at me.
I don't hate her, Devi,
she said with a good portion of resignation.
Wish I could say the same about you, Mrs. Whitehall.
Belle's voice caught her attention and their gazes locked.
But you hurt the love of my life, and we have an open beef to settle.
We will,
Mum nodded curtly, moving in our direction almost gingerly.
First, can I touch your belly?
It is oh so full of baby, and looking at both of you, I just know the child will be gorgeous.
You can cop a feel, Mrs. W.,
Swevin warned, but that doesn't mean you're off of my shit list.
Good God, I loved that woman. My mother put her hands on Belle's belly and grinned up at her.
She's kicking.
How do you know it's a she? I asked.
A woman knows.
She pulled away, smiling at us enigmatically. There was nothing more to say, really. This wasn't a part of a reconciliation or an olive branch. It was a quiet, dignified goodbye. A goodbye that should have happened 2 decades ago. My mother gathered my hands in hers and I let her, one last time.
I just want you to know I do love you, Devon, in my own roundabout way.
I believed her. But sometimes a bit of love was simply not enough.
Chapter 39. Devon.
How come most airlines don't have first-class seats anymore? Emma Bell pouted next to me on the flight back home later that evening. She was munching on dried fruit. I flipped a page in the Wall Street Journal, taking a sip of my virgin Bloody Mary, possibly the only virgin I had ever consumed. I would have gone for whiskey, but Bell was the kind of woman who insisted I sympathize with her by staying sober. There was hardly any difference between first and business class to begin with. Add to that the fact that business class seats by definition count as a work expense, and you'll get why most Western airlines don't want to be bothered.
Why are you asking? I glanced her way.
She shifted uncomfortably in her seat, looking left and right.
There's not enough leg room.
I tapped my lap, folding the paper and tucking it under my arm. Put your feet on me. Problem solved.
No, not for that. Oh, shit. Fuck, I mean, this is bullshit.
She scoffed, rubbing at her forehead.
Please continue, I sat back. I love it when you whisper sweet nothings to me.
But she didn't. She waited until we were exactly at the halfway point between the United Kingdom and the United States. Beneath us, there was nothing but the giant, deep expanse of the Atlantic. All that kept us in the air was a tiny metal tube and faith. And suddenly, I realized exactly the analogy she was trying to make. That marriage was about giving and taking. About making concessions and meeting each other halfway.
Okay, don't hate me if I screw it up, or if I can't get up or anything. This baby is messing with my center of gravity.
Belle plucked a square velvet thing from her purse and stood up, before crouching to one knee and groaning in annoyance. I sat up straight, every bone in my body screaming at me to pay attention. Everyone in business class turned their sleepy gazes in our direction.
Devon Whitehall, you're the best man I've ever met by leaps and bounds. I have been in love with you from the first moment our gazes met. I want to grow old with you, to be with you through thick and thin, to have your last name. I know I've been difficult the past few months, but I promise I'm a changed woman. Please, would you do me the honor of becoming my husband?
Yes. There was more to be said. But for now, this one word seemed to sum it up. People clapped from the seats beside us. One woman took a picture of the whole thing on her phone, but somehow I couldn't care less if we wound up being on the cover of a tabloid.
Oh, Dev.
Belle covered her mouth with her hands, tears welling in her eyes.
This is awesome. Now, can you please help me up?
Epilogue. Belle. Did you know that when a male and female anglerfish mate, they melt into each other and share bodies forever? When the anglerfish bloke finds a willing participant, he latches and fuses with her. He loses his eyes and a load of his internal organs until they share a bloodstream. Devon strokes my hand lovingly, peering at me from his seat by my hospital bed.
Wow, I say dryly, holding my breath to stop the pain. Sounds familiar. I turn to Nurse, pretending she's not there, who beams at both of us like she's just given birth, popping my chart back onto the edge of my bed. I just felt another contraction, and this one was bad. So bad, I thought my stomach was about to rip in two.
When's Dr. Bjorn coming? Devin demanded, spurring into action. My wife is in pain.
Your wife is not the first woman ever to give birth. Nurse, about to get punched, notes mildly. She moves to refluff the pillows behind me. Two different doctors came in for a checkup and said everything is perfectly fine. Dr. Bjorn is dealing with some light traffic. He'll be here in a few minutes. You can always opt for an epidural. She peers down at me, shrugging. Are you kidding me? I want this kid to know how much I suffered for her and hold it over her head for eternity. She laughs. I don't know why. I am not kidding.
Sweetheart, we're fine. You've still got time.
Devin coos, stroking my hair out of place. It's all nice and romantic, and yet I'm about to push an 8-pound human out of me without any drugs. I slap his hand away. Go get me, Dr. Bjorn.
As you wish, Mrs. Whitehall.
He cannot speed out of the room fast enough, and I remain with Nurse looking at me like I'm crazy. Devin and I married each other shortly after we came back from England. It was a small, intimate ceremony in Madame Mayhem. The bridesmaids wore red lingerie and garters and couldn't say shit about it. My wedding, my rules. Sam Brennan almost punched the walls down in the room when he saw his wife ushering me across the aisle in lingerie. Things have been really awesome between us. Almost too awesome. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and think, today is going to be the day I screw this up and bail on him. Or more often than not, today is going to be the day that he leaves me. That he finally understands that I'm too damaged, too broken, or simply too much. But somehow, neither of these things happen, and I finish my days in the same way, draped over my husband, sharing our stories and experiences from the day, watching TV, laughing, and unveiling piece after piece of one another. I know there will come a day when I eventually stop worrying that he is going to break me too. That day might not be today or even tomorrow, but it will arrive. Devin Whitehall, after all, is the man who taught me the most important life lesson, that you can still believe.
I got you a doctor.
Devin bursts into the room now, panting.
One you know, no less.
Is it Dr. Bjorn? I bark, twisting in my hospital bed. Is it just me, or is the baby half out? Something's going on between my legs, but for obvious reasons, I'm not in a physical position to bend down and check.
Better,
Devin says, and he and Ashling appear in front of me. My face falls. I'm not letting this bitch see my vagina. But she is already walking over to the little sink and washing her hands, slapping on a pair of fresh plastic gloves. I've seen worse. Oh, I don't mean that. It looks fantastic. I just don't feel like I'm ready to take our relationship to the next level. I huff. But then there's another contraction and I scream, and Devin and Ashling rush toward me.
Swevin,
Devin utters in pain, wiping the sweat from my brow lovingly.
I'm so sorry I put you in this position.
You put me in 27 different ones.
That's why we're here,
I quip. Still don't want my help? Ashling elevates an eyebrow. Because I'm happy to call another doctor. Dr. Lin is here. Nurse, no one asked you, volunteers unhelpfully.
I don't know, Dr. Lin, and Dr. Bjorn is obviously too busy braving the Boston traffic.
Fine, I throw my hands in the air. Fine, just get this baby out of me, Ash. Devin snatches my hand. Ashling gets to business. And 20 minutes later, just when Dr. Bjorn enters the room full of apologies, Nicola Zara Constance Whitehall is born. And before you ask, of course I added Constance to make sure everyone knows she's a royal. I am not exaggerating when I say my newborn is the prettiest I've ever seen, with smooth pink skin, bright eyes, and the pinkest lips. She is fragile, innocent, and perfect. I want to protect her from every possible harm. I know I can't, but at least for now I can. But for later, when she grows up, all I can do is try and raise her to be as strong as her mother.
My goodness, she looks just like her mother.
Devin kisses me, then Nicola, then hugs Aisling close. With my beautiful baby in my arms and my friends and family waiting outside, I know one thing. Everything will not be okay. Because it's already perfect.
Devin. 6 months later. I donate Whitehall Court Castle to the English Heritage Foundation. It becomes a museum. A part of me, an extremely minuscule part of me, is sad that I'm giving up the Marquis title, that I will not be in England to ensure Nicola inherits some sort of title. But most of me is glad I am out of this place I could never truly call home. Nicola is growing at a fast pace. Currently, she is sporting a shock of white curls that look suspiciously like ramen noodles. She tries to sink her gums into anything she can get her chubby hands on and is a complete delight. Emmabel got back to work a month ago. She appointed Ross the official manager of Madame Mayhem and is now focusing on her latest venture. She opened a non-profit organization for women and men who have been sexually assaulted, providing therapy and help with finding work and getting back on their feet. Her new secretary, actually, the person to replace Simon and do all the filing and administrative work, is Donna Hammond, Frank's ex-girlfriend. She has a baby boy now. His name is Thomas, and sometimes, when he and Nicola are in the same room, they stare at each other with wide, "Wait, you're a tiny human too," expressions. Now I'm picking up my wife from her parents. Nicola naps blissfully in the back of my Bentley. I catch my father-in-law watering the plants on the front porch and roll the passenger window down. "Hey, John, would you tell Belle I'm outside?" He looks up from the flowers, smiles, and nods. Dumping the hose on the grass, he walks into the house and comes back with my wife. Their arms are laced together, and he opens the passenger seat for her and kisses her on the temple before taking a step back. "Drive safely," he instructs, peeking at Nicola in the back seat, smiling. She is growing so fast. "Don't they all?" Belle murmurs. "I love you, Belly Belle." "Love you, Daddy." Belle and I drive to Logan International Airport. The entire journey, my stomach is in knots. "It's going to be fine," Belle assures me, rubbing at my thigh. "I know, it's just been a while." "She's still your family," my wife points out. "I know that, too." When we reach the airport and unbuckle Nicola from her car seat and put her in the carrier strapped onto Belle, my wife automatically heads toward the stairway from the parking lot to the main floor. "No," I grab her hand, squeezing. "Let's take the elevator." She whips her head around, frowning.
"You sure?"
"Positive, darling." We wait at the appropriate gate, and even though I've put my family's woes behind me, I'm still on pins and needles. The dumbwaiter had been sealed up shortly after I took control over the estate. It helped soothe some of my anxiety over my claustrophobia, but not all of it. When Cecilia gave me a call and asked if she could come and see baby Nicola, I said yes. She wasn't, after all, my mother nor my father. She never tried to kill me. When I asked Belle if I should offer to pay for Cecilia's flight and accommodations, she said, "Absolutely not. Let her show you that she's changed." And she has. Cecilia paid for everything for this trip with the money she makes working at a library near the university she goes to. She's a changed woman. When I see my sister coming out of the terminal's gate, I rush toward her, my heart feeling lighter. She looks the same. Perhaps she lost a couple pounds, but her smile is different. Genuine. Carefree. We meet halfway, share a bone-crushing hug, and she cries into my shoulder. I let her. I know she feels it too. Orphaned.
After all, when it was all done and dealt with, Ursula turned her back on her too and went to live in London with a friend.
Thank you for giving me another chance, Cecilia murmurs into my shoulder.
Thank you for wanting one. I feel my wife's hand on my back, supporting me, hugging me from behind, making sure I'm never out of balance.
Come on,
Belle says softly.
Let's go make some new family memories.
So we do. The end.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Rake, Boston Bells, Book 4. Written by L.J. Shen. Performed by Joe Arden and Maxine Mitchell. Executive producers, Louise Quayle and Mike Charzik. Producer, Sarah Kosa Baglusa. Copyright 2022 by L.J. Shen. Sound recording copyright 2021 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.